thank you so much, Robert Parker, for being with us here on Writer's Voice.
My pleasure.
You have written over 50 books since your first Spencer novel was published in, was it 1973?
Actually, 74.
74,
is the book date, January 74. Yeah, I have. I think it's 55, but I'm not sure because I'm about five or six books ahead. So,
got it.
It's a lot.
Got it. So your readers don't have any lulls to worry about.
No. If I keel over in mid conversation here, they've still got at least five more books.
Excellent. Did you just decide to be a writer?
I guess I always wanted to be, and just took me a while to get myself into a position where I could. I got married early and had children young, which are the two best things I ever did. But in those days, I had to support them, and I had to work.
Yeah.
And I can't write a few hours here and there while I'm working full-time someplace. So it took me a while to weasel my way into the academic world and become a professor, where there is then quite a lot of time to write.
And what is your style for writing? It sounds like you spend large expanses of time at once.
I need uninterrupted time. I need... Normally, I write... every day, 5 days a week, I write 10 pages a day. I don't revise. I don't do a second draft. And I would normally start somewhere in the 8 to 10 o'clock range in the morning, and I would finish in the 2 to 4 o'clock range in the afternoon. And I'd take a nap. I would go to the gym and try and rescue what little is left. And that's my day.
So you don't revise?
Nope.
Wow.
You know, I mean, I work on a computer, and as I go along, if I don't like something I've just written, I go back and change it. But once it's out of the printer at the end of the day, it's gone. I don't read it again. I've never read one of my books all the way through. But they're good, though.
They are.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Talk about fishing for a compliment.
Right. Do you do a lot of planning before you start writing?
No, I do not. I have only a vague premise. In school days, the current book, readily available at your bookseller, even as we speak, I just said to myself, okay, I'll write about Spencer investigating a sort of Columbine High School shooting. And that's what I knew going in. And so you sit down, you write chapter one, which introduces the topic, introduces the client, introduces Spencer, establishes, you know, you got to figure out who did the shooting and who's hiring Spencer and why. Pretty well takes care of your first chapter, and the second one goes out of the first. You've now got three characters instead of just one in your head, and it evolves that way.
That's amazing.
All of that is that it sort of mimics what the detective goes through. He's looking for the story, and so am I.
You're listening to Writer's Voice on WMUA Amherst. We're talking with Robert Parker. I was really impressed reading this book that... Spencer just goes and has these conversations, and things don't really wind up neatly. You know, he it seems for a while as though he's consistently having this experience of, pissing people off as he's talking to them.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And yet he still gets someplace.
Yeah, he did. Most people don't like to be talked to about subjects that they don't want to talk about, and he's also probably... slightly abrasive in the irony with which he views life. But yeah, he gets there. He plugs along. So do I.
Do you find yourself similar to him in any way, or do you draw on what do you draw on?
Well, I draw on my imagination. I'm more annoying than he is, but other than that, we're not too much alike. He's taller. No, I make this stuff up. You know, what I draw on is what any good fiction writer draws on, or even bad fiction writers. They imagine things. I don't look at the daily news. I don't have any current events in my head when I start, particularly. I draw on my own experience, which is not to say that I've ever been a cop or anything. Merely what I've got inside comes out. You know, if you've ever gotten one punch in the nose, you need know most of what you need about fighting, and if you've ever heard one shot fired in anger, you know pretty much what you need to know about gunshots and stuff like that. You know, you can develop it.
What made you want to write a book about the Columbine sort of school shooting?
It was time to write a book, and that's the thought that came into my head when I sat down to think. I wanted to... I'm interested in the, you know, I've always thought education was one of the great scams in the history of the world. I wondered what goes on, why the school is the target of so much rage, not just people with guns shooting, but graffiti, anger. I myself dislike school from kindergarten through my years as a professor. That's a long time to dislike it, and I was sort of played with what might happen to some people when they go to school. As it turns out, the story took me someplace else, and I have not done much of an examination of the educational system, which is probably all to the good, because it's probably pretty boring. But anyway, that's sort of the way that mine began to work.
It makes me think about the end of school days, where there is a little bit of that, that kind of mm-hmm. processing conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you about Susan.
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Well, she frames the book,
mm-hmm.
But she's not in it, really.
Not this time, no. No, she's, what did you wish to ask? Why she's not in it, or why she framed the book?
Well, why she framed the book.
I just thought it was time for him to go off on his own a little bit see how he's like alone. You know, I've written about him 35 times. Sometimes he's with Susan, sometimes he's with Hawk, sometimes he's with both of them. And now and then he's with me, neither. Sometimes with other people. It's just, you don't want the same meal every day.
And they have such a well-described relationship, even though she's so tangential in the book.
Yeah, well, she's far less tangential in some other books.
Sure,
and,
sure.
I myself have had a dandy relationship with the girl of my dreams for 49 years, actually for 55 years, but we've been married for 49. And that fact creeps into the work, I think. Susan isn't Joan. Joan's better than Susan. She's far less self-absorbed than Susan. And superficially, there's great differences, you know. Susan's Jewish, divorced, childless. Joan is none of those things. Susan's a shrink. Joan isn't. But the feelings that they have for each other and the way he feels about her is close to our feelings here at this house.
That's really beautiful. I wonder if you'd mind reading just a little snippet on, there's this bit that I just loved on page 294, just talking about how they could listen to each other talking for the longest time.
First, I got to get a copy of the book.
Oh,
yeah.
Sorry about that.
Hang on while I get a copy. I just happen to have several dozen.
Several dozen. Which is, we can say again that it's available in bookstores every place, and that this Friday night you'll be
this at... This Sunday it debuts in the New York Times bestsellerist at number 3.
Oh, fantastic. Congratulations.
What are we on? Page 294?
Right.
Hang on.
And on Friday you'll be at the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley.
Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, yeah.
7 o'clock Friday night.
Okay, where do you want to start with Jared really didn't have much of a chance? Let's start there. Jared really didn't have much of a chance, Susan said. No. I had my arm around Susan's shoulder. Her head was on my chest. The other kid probably didn't either, Susan said. No. A lot of kids don't have a chance, do they, Susan said. You and I see the adult residue of that every day, I said. Perhaps the one absolute essential to growing up well is being tough enough, Susan said. Like us, I said. Just like us, Susan said. But maybe not so lucky. I'd have found you, I said, with or without luck. She smiled and kissed me gently on the mouth. Probably not, she said, but if someone could, it would be you. Okay?
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. Beautifully read, too, I thought.
Very, very much. How did you wind up becoming a professor? I mean, you're propagating the educational system. do you feel guilty about that?
Right.
Right, exactly.
In my defense, I wasn't a very good professor, but I get to be a full professor of English at Northeastern University. When I left about 1978, somewhere in there, I was teaching one class a week on Wednesdays from 12 to 3. I mean, I didn't meet every Wednesday, and I can't stand that kind of a burden. But
terrible
left
life.
A lot of time to write. I used to work. I mean, I used to work like real jobs, you know, at Raytheon and the Curtis Wright Aircraft and Prudential Insurance Company. And mm-hmm. When I started teaching there, when I was a tenured professor at Northeastern, they told me my load was 9 hours. I thought they meant a day. That's a week.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's why I did it. That's why I got the PhD in the first place, so I could be a professor, so I would have time to write. It was Joan's idea, actually.
It seems to have worked out quite well.
Hmm?
It seems to have worked out quite well.
It has indeed, yes. Now I don't have to go anywhere, and I commute from my bedroom to my office about 15 feet down the hall.
Wonderful. I'm Jody Schneider, and this is Writer's Voice on WMUA Amherst, 91.1 FM. I'm talking with Robert Parker, mystery author whose most recent book is School Days. You did your PhD about mysteries, so...
Actually, I did my PhD about the evolution of the American hero.
Okay.
Context of the Protestant religion and Western expansion. But two of the chapters were about Hammond and Chandler.
Mm-hmm.
And that means a lot less than you'd think it would mean. It took me 2 weeks to write the dissertation. It was done in order to get a PhD, and it succeeded, and that allowed me to get tenure, and that allowed me to write, and here I am. But I don't mean to dismiss the what I learned in getting a PhD, which probably adds a certain luminosity or ulteriority, I think was Frost's word, to what I write. But I didn't learn to write, and I learned nothing about detective story writing from getting a PhD. It was a means to an end.
Did you revise your PhD at all?
Oh, probably. The academic world loves revision. It took me 2 weeks, so I didn't do a hell of a lot of revising.
Right.
But I'm sure I probably had to change punctuation and revise my footnote form and that sort of thing under the duress of one of my readers. That was quite a long time ago, so I don't remember in detail. I got my PhD dissertation written and submitted in 1970, so 35 years ago. But anyway, it was done. We got there, and it was passed. And you can still get it from University Microfilms in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Let me totally change the topic and ask you, as I was first going along reading School Days, I was really thrown when we met the shooter's parents.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk in this very flat way.
Yeah.
The father comes to the door. How can we help?
Mm-hmm.
He gets shown to the kid's room. May we leave you? Without any question marks. I mean, do you really mean that as just flat? What is it saying about those characters?
Well, what would you think it would be saying if they were very flat speaking and the language was flat and they seemed to show no emotion? Probably that they were flat and unemotional people, and it probably didn't do the kid any good growing up among them. Also probably suggests maybe that they have repressed whatever feelings they might have about this. It would be pretty awful if your firstborn child were in jail for murder. You'd have to repress something.
Hmm.
Mine are free, by the way. Both of mine are out free. They're not in jail for anything.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I'm so proud.
And you haven't recently like cleaned out their rooms or anything. Because that was the other thing about these parents. I mean, the son is in jail and his room has been totally clear. Nothing in the drawers, nothing on the walls.
That's right. Get rid of it all if they could.
I sort of wondered later on, you know, gee, was there ever anything on the walls? Given this
we don't know, but you might wonder. Yeah, so they don't really have rooms here anymore. They're 46 and 42, and they aren't here too often.
Sure. You've also written about baseball and westerns and things of that sort.
Yep.
I was told to ask you about your baseball stories.
The novel is Double Play. It is
right.
About the advent of Jackie Robinson, who you sound like you might be just a little young to remember firsthand. But in 1947, the Brooklyn Dodgers brought the first black player in the history of Major League Baseball to the majors, Jackie Robinson. And it was quite a social and historical occasion. It was, I think Robinson was one of the great men of the 20th century. And I sort of wanted to tip my hat to him. I was 15 when it happened, so I was avidly following it. It's quite good. You really ought to read it and tell all your friends to read it, or at least buy it.
Growing up in Springfield, you were in this, I mean, in this zone of radio listening, I guess, on the...
Yep. I was born in Springfield. I left Springfield when I was 11. And spent the next number of years around New Bedford before we ended up when I was 18 in Boston, where I have remained. We listened to the Dodger games on radio. The broadcast up would come floating up the Connecticut River Valley. And in those days, Boston baseball wasn't played or broadcast on Sundays because of the Blue Laws. So my father would be working in the yard. He'd have the New York games on the radio, and the station we got best was the one that did the Brooklyn Dodger game, so I was kind of a Brooklyn Dodger fan, though badly misplaced in the New England area. So that Robinson meant something extra special to me.
Has any of that changed living, living more firmly in Red Sox territory?
Well, yeah, the Dodgers moved to Los Angeles, which ended my affinity for them.
Do you have something against Los Angeles, or just that it's far away?
No, for the Brooklyn Dodgers to abandon Brooklyn would be like abandoning your children in a storm. Pete Hamill once said, the three worst men in history are Hitler, Stalin, and Walter O'Malley, who was the owner of the Dodgers who moved them to California. It was blatantly economic, and it left 2 million fans heartbroken and so forth. And it was just hard for me to root for the Los Angeles Dodgers. No, I have nothing against Los Angeles. I rather like Los Angeles. Mm. One of my sons lives there. I frolic about in the movie business some. Used to own a house in L.A. But I don't root for the L.A. Dodgers.
When Spencer is meeting with his client, Mrs. Elworth, the grandmother,
mm-hmm.
he says, "Let B be the end of seam," and she replies, "The only emperor is the emperor of ice cream." Where is that from?
Wallace Stevens, a poem called The Emperor of Ice Cream.
How did that find its way into this book?
I don't know. It was in my imagination, seemed right at the time. Seemed to be the right thing to say at the time I was writing it. Spencer is reasonably literate.
And clearly you are as well.
Well, you know, I was a professor. That doesn't mean you're literate. I've
been, no, never unfortunately,
mind.
Right.
Never mind. Yes, it's not so much that I'm literate, it's that I don't forget things.
Mm-hmm.
My mind is full of allusions to popular music and old movies and, poems I've read and stuff like that. Just the kind of a ragtag mind I happen to have. And when I'm writing along, it pops up.
Yeah.
I also wanted the opportunity for the grandmother to show that she was a little literate herself.
She's a funny woman.
Mm-hmm.
I really got a good sense of her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one tries to make mm-hmm. them interesting.
So, how many books do you write a year?
About 4 or 5, depending on how my year's going. That's why I'm somewhat ahead of the publisher who brings out 3. So I'm stacking them up a little. They'll be valuable whenever it's time to publish them.
Mm-hmm.
Leave them for my children's inheritance if I have to.
Fantastic. You don't revise, but do you ever wholesale throw something out, say, this is not working, I can't finish this?
Nope, or never did.
Or I finished this and I don't think it's worth reading?
Nope, never did that either. We don't waste stuff around here. It's good enough.
It's good enough.
No, I've never done that. It seems to get as good as it's going to get the first try. And I don't seem to, I don't have any sense that I'd get better if I did it over. However good that may be, I like it.
It's, I think, speaks to your sense of your memory, to
mm-hmm.
to be able to write through the book the first time, know that, you know, it's all there, it all makes sense, and it all does.
Yeah, that's
and then
right.
to just get to the end.
I trust my memory. I do, at the end, ask Joan to read through the book once just to make sure I haven't committed some kind of public disgrace, you know, and she will tell me it's okay. And when I do the Sonny Randall books, which are about a woman in the first person, then she's much more active participant in the book writing. She reads pretty much every day or every other day and guides me through the intricacies of a feminine point of view, which is different.
It certainly is. Well, I...
Vive la difference, as they say.
Right. Anything I should have asked you that I...
Yeah,
you
should have asked me if that was... if I had a model pose for the picture on the back of the book, or is that really me?
All right. So is it really you?
I'm the taller of the two. Yeah.
All right. And this dog on the back, that actually...
That's Pearl the Wonder Dog.
That's Pearl the real dog.
Yeah, it's the real dog.
And how did she find her way into your books?
Because she's found her way into my heart. I've had 3 Pearls. All look like that. All German short-haired pointers. All females. All chocolate brown. And when one dies, after 15 or 16 years, I replace her with another one, same name, same breed. If you have a pedigree dog, you pretty well get the same dog back. It's almost like cloning. So I've had a Pearl now for 30 years, and she seemed at some point to be a good candidate for mention in a novel. Joan's dog, Rosie, is also popping up in the Sonny Randall books.
Wow. Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
I'm glad you mentioned that.
Well, I'm glad, too. Bye-bye.
Robert Parker will be speaking at the Odyssey Bookshop tonight at 7 p.m. For more information, call 534-7307 or visit odysseybks.com. Again, 534-7307 or odysseybks.com. That's odysseybks.com.